Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian and German. Babbel is designed to quickly get you speaking your new language within weeks, and their convenient lessons are only 10 to 15 minutes each. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, not by a translation machine. Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all devices. Here are the easy steps to speak a new language with confidence. Download the app or go to babbel.com. Select the language of your choice and try it for free. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Monday, the 16th of September, these are our main stories. In Hong Kong, clashes between police and democracy protesters have continued into the night after a day that saw several people injured. Exit polls in Tunisia's presidential election suggest an independent outsider, Kais Saied, has done well in the first round. 26 candidates are standing. And Saudi Arabia says it'll ensure that there won't be any oil shortages despite Saturday's drone attacks on two of its biggest petroleum facilities. Also in this podcast,
it's described as the richest collection of rare and unique Viking Age objects ever found in Britain or Ireland.
And now the Church of Scotland wants its cut of the booty. We begin in Hong Kong. Water cannon and tear gas being used against crowds of protesters on the 15th straight weekend of anti-government action. Several people were reported to have been badly injured in clashes between pro- and anti-Beijing forces after an unsanctioned march turned violent. Protests have persisted in the territory despite the decision by Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, to scrap the controversial extradition law that provided the initial catalyst for the demonstrations. This high school student explained why he came out on Sunday.
Because it's our freedom to do so. We have our right to go to protest, to the streets, and we have to voice our demands to the government.
James Kumarasamy heard more about Sunday's events from our correspondent in Hong Kong, Nick Beek.
The day evolved in the way that it has done over the past 15 weekends, the protests that we've seen here in Hong Kong. Initially, there was a large gathering. We saw families, old and young, marching peacefully through the streets. Although today, people were defying a police ban. The Hong Kong police force had not given permission for this, and so lots of people, thousands of them, were risking arrest. But nonetheless, they came out onto the streets. But it was when the families went home that once again we saw this violence. A hardcore element targeted the government building here in Hong Kong, and Molotov cocktails were thrown at the police, bricks and bottles, and they then responded with some considerable force. They fired tear gas and also water cannon was used. We know this is a new tactic the police are trying to use to try and extinguish these protests, but you know, it hasn't worked. And although it cleared the streets for a time, there is no end in sight to this protest movement.
Are the demands changing of the protesters?
No, they're not. And I think this is why we've reached a stalemate, because the government here has given in to one demand. Not many people thought they would, but Carrie Lam, the chief executive, has said officially that the extradition bill, which sparked this crisis some three long months ago, is dead and it will be withdrawn. But there are four other demands that the protesters have. And I think the main two for them would be this independent investigation into the way the police have behaved over the past 3 months. But also, whether or not they'll get this from Beijing, I think it's highly unlikely. They want political reform. They want to be able to elect the people who run the authorities here, and they want to be able to choose their own chief executive. They don't like being given a short list of people approved by Beijing.
As far as the way the authorities and the police in particular are dealing with the demonstrators, is that evolving?
The police have taken a tougher line over the past few months or so, but I think what's quite interesting is the role of China and the response not on the street, not in the battle for the streets, but in the battle for the hearts and minds, as it were, of people, because we've seen pro-Beijing media and also state media in Beijing. They're desperate to characterise this as a social problem. They're talking about improving the prospects for young people in Hong Kong. But if you talk to the people on the streets, as we did today, they're not interested in this. It's not so much how much money they've got in their pocket. It's the sort of life they can lead in the future. And many people do not want Hong Kong to become like any other city in mainland China. They want their freedoms to be protected.
And judging from the images, there seem to be a lot of calls for the UK, the United States, to get more involved.
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting development. Today we heard the strains of God Save the Queen being sung at the British consulate.
God save the Queen.
Not huge numbers there, but people were trying to make the point that the former British colony should be better protected by the British, and that this, of course, gives Beijing the opportunity to say, what we've got here is not a Hong Kong affair, but foreign governments meddling and, you know, interfering, and really they're not welcome. And this protest movement, they would claim, is being stoked up and perpetuated by foreign powers.
That was Nick Beek in Hong Kong. Beijing officials are watching developments in Hong Kong very closely, but the protests aren't the only thing on their minds. On October the 1st, China will mark the 70th anniversary of the communist takeover with a military parade in the capital. Bureaucrats are going to great lengths to make sure nothing goes wrong, even at the risk of angering Beijing's pigeon fanciers, as our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow reports.
The authorities in Beijing have banned the flying of pigeons for the next 2 weeks until the military parade is over. They've told owners to keep their birds locked up in their coops. They've also banned the popular pastime of kite flying. Balloons, drones and lanterns have been grounded. These regulations have been introduced to ensure the airspace over China's capital will be free of obstacles for military aircraft to practice. Officials don't want anything to go wrong for the parade. These strict regulations are the kind of micromanagement beloved of Chinese officials planning a major spectacle. That's why they'll be worried about events that they cannot control in Hong Kong. The Beijing parade will celebrate the Communist Party's ascent to power in 1949. China wants the world to focus on the achievements of the party over the last 70 years, not on its failings, laid out for all to see in Hong Kong. In China, leaders will be concerned that protesters in the former British colony are planning a rival parade for October the 1st. And in Hong Kong, many are wondering whether Beijing will allow such an event to take place.
That was Michael Bristow. Tunisia has held its second free presidential election since the 2011 uprising that toppled the long-time ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. There are 26 candidates, including two women, running in the election, which was brought forward from November after the death of the country's first democratically elected president in July. The vote has been held against a backdrop of economic problems, with unemployment a persistent issue. This voter explained why she cast her ballot.
I voted because I want less corruption, clean hands, less poverty, the return of the middle class. I voted because all we have now is very rich or very poor people. We have a shortage of medicine and our health sector has suffered in Tunisia. Security has declined, we leave our homes and we do not feel safe anymore. I want all of this to return. That is why I voted.
Exit polls suggest an independent outsider, Kais Saied, is ahead in the first round. A candidate needs a majority of votes to win the election. If no one gets a majority in the first round, the two candidates with the most votes will face a second decisive round. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston says a robust campaign and peaceful rallies are rare in the region.
We all watched those Arab Spring revolutions unfold across the region 8 years ago. Tunisia is where they began, and Tunisia is the only country to have really benefited from its revolt. It didn't descend into war or anarchy. It didn't go back to authoritarianism. Instead, democracy took root in Tunisia. And this electoral campaign has been hard fought. There were live television debates involving all the candidates, pretty well unprecedented in the Arab world. And it's impossible to predict the outcome of this election, not something you often say about elections in the Arab world. So the revolt brought democracy, but it didn't deliver on much else. The very deep economic and social problems that helped pave the way for the revolution remain unresolved. Many Tunisians feel they're worse off today than they were before the revolution. And so in the run-up to the vote, you did get signs of a good deal of apathy, people complaining about their politicians, the system, not really believing that voting would change that much. And electoral officials have been worried that turnout might be much lower than they would like. In fact, they made a rather desperate plea in the afternoon around 3 p.m., urging young people especially to go out and make use of those democratic rights that they fought so hard for 8 years ago.
That was Alan Johnston. Saudi Arabia says it's making sure there won't be any shortages after Saturday's attacks on its oil facilities. The drone strikes caused a big drop in Saudi oil output, but the authorities in Riyadh say they aim to reverse a third of the losses by Monday. Riyadh says crude oil production has been cut to 5.7 million barrels a day. That's about half the kingdom's usual output. Earlier, the European Union said the attacks on Saudi oil facilities were a real threat to security in the Middle East. Iran has dismissed US allegations that it was behind the attacks. Houthi rebels in Yemen, who are aligned with Tehran, say they carried out the strikes in retaliation for the Saudi bombing campaign against them. Siavash Ardalan of the BBC Persian service told us more.
We know that the Houthis have taken responsibility for the attack launched on Saudi Arabia's oil installation. We know that the U.S. is not buying that version. It's directly accusing Iran of being involved in the attack and even suggesting that the attacks may not have originated from Yemen itself, which is what was evident in Secretary Pompeo's tweet.
Now, how credible then is the Houthis' claim that they launched the attack?
Well, you have to look at the map as a distance of 1,400 kilometers between the border of Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the oil installations all the way up north in Saudi Arabia. So if the Houthis has managed to launch a drone that far, it represents a huge breakthrough, not just in their capabilities, but in Iran's ability to assist the Houthis and train them and give them equipment. Otherwise, that attack could have originated anywhere from ranging from the Shiite areas close to the oil installation in Saudi Arabia itself, which is what some people have suggested, or from the territory of Iraq, where Iran also has its proxy forces.
So how is all of this affecting the already difficult relationship between Iran and the US?
You would think that it would have raised tensions between the two countries, especially after Secretary Pompeo's tweet directly accusing Iran. But apparently it hasn't, because even the White House spokesman, they didn't rule out a possibility of a meeting again between President Rouhani and Trump next week on the sidelines of the UN agenda, just saying that this attack would not help that. But they haven't ruled it out. They haven't called for a special UN Security Council session. They haven't overreacted in any way that you would expect. Some people, more pessimistic, you know, outlook might say, well, that's just, you know, the Trump administration being happy to use that as a pretext to sell Saudi Arabia more, you know, missiles and more anti-drone equipment and more military contracts. And some people might say that it's just both Iran and the U.S. are, you know, hoping that somehow they can save face and at the same time engage in some kind of a dialogue. And they don't want anything else to derail that, especially given that even the Saudis themselves haven't accused Iran.
That was Siavash Ardalan of BBC Persian. The International Committee of the Red Cross has worked in Afghanistan for 30 years, but in April it had to freeze many of its programs in Taliban-controlled areas because the militants said they couldn't guarantee the charity's security. Now the Taliban are lifting that ban, a move welcomed by the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Afghanistan, Juan Pedro Scherer. Our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering, reports.
For the past 5 months, the ICRC's work in Afghanistan has been limited, with staff unable to access remote rural areas controlled by the Taliban. Juan Pedro Scherer said the hope now was to resume the range of programmes which had been put abruptly on hold.
Health support for health clinics which are in rural areas, facilitating the transfer of war wounded patients, facilitating the transfer of mortal remains from the battlefield to their families. Certain projects for the benefit of communities, such as providing safe water for people in rural areas. All these activities which were taking place in areas where the Talibans have control or are disputed were put on standby.
In April, the Taliban's announcement of the ban seemed to catch the ICRC by surprise. They'd only just held talks with Taliban leaders and no problems had been raised. Some analysts suggest it revealed differences between the political leadership and the group's military commission, which announced the ban. Since then, they've quietly held fresh negotiations in Doha, trying to rebuild trust and to address the issue which was apparently at the heart of the disagreement, Taliban anger about the treatment of its fighters in Afghan prisons. Mr. Scherer said it's an issue on the ICRC's agenda, but as a politically neutral player.
At the end of the day, while the ICRC is seeking in its work and to with the detaining authorities to improve the situation in the different prisons, be it in terms of treatment, be it in terms of condition or access to healthcare, we are not the ones responsible for the detained population. But this was, again, an issue which came out, and we have been working on this also with the Afghan authorities and to see how we could increase our support to the Afghan authorities and in particular to the detention authorities in order to improve the situation.
Today's news is positive, but a reminder too that Afghanistan is a complex and fluid environment. Organisations like the ICRC must navigate factions and divisions within the Taliban and within the government, but also assess the risks from other militants, including the Islamic State group, which allegedly killed 6 ICRC workers last year.
That was Jill McGivering. Still to come in this podcast,
there are children of stars, and then there are children of legend. It's a huge shadow.
The daughter of the American singer and actress Judy Garland talks about her mother's enduring appeal. Union officials and human rights activists in Zimbabwe fear that the head of a doctors' union, Peter Magombe, has been abducted by the security forces. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross is following the story.
All that Peter Magombe's colleagues are saying from the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association is that they received a WhatsApp message by mobile phone that said that he was being kidnapped by men. So it was actually sort of while it was going on, he managed to get this message out to say, I'm being kidnapped. This is what they're alleging. And since then, that phone's been switched off. He's completely unreachable. And they believe that there's a link between him disappearing and the role he's played in getting doctors and nurses to go on strike.
So what are the authorities saying?
So the police have put out a message saying we're investigating the matter. But interestingly, and perhaps a little bizarrely for a police statement, they're saying the possibility of a third force being involved cannot be ruled out. And they talk about this third force using politics in this matter to sustain what they call the human rights abuse narrative ahead of the UN General Assembly meeting. So what they're really saying is that it looks, from the police point of view, as though it's possible that some opposition people or people opposed to the government of Zimbabwe are either stage managing this abduction or they're making the whole thing up in order to make the government look bad.
This wouldn't be the first case of an activist being abducted in Zimbabwe, would it?
No, and the last few months have seen a worrying spate of abductions. Some of them activists who have criticised the government, some people who were trying to organise protests, and before they managed to get people out on the streets, they were arrested to stop that protest action going ahead. And famously, one last month that we reported on as well was that of a female comedian who had done a sketch that seemed to be a bit too close to the bone for the authorities. She was picked up in the middle of the night, stripped naked, tortured and dumped by the side of the road.
That was Will Ross. Now to an unholy row between the Church of Scotland, or the Kirk, and a treasure hunter who unearthed Viking artefacts with his metal detector. Derek McLennan uncovered the 10th century collection of rare Viking relics in a field in 2014. The National Museum of Scotland paid Mr. McLennan £2 million, that's around $2.5 million, for the find, and the Kirk, which owns the land, says it's entitled to about half the value of the bounty. From Edinburgh, Maura Kinnebrough.
The treasure trove is known as the Galloway Hoard. It's described as the richest collection of rare and unique Viking Age objects ever found in Britain or Ireland. There are 100 items in total that were found, mainly jewellery like brooches, pins, an armlet. There's beads and ingots made of gold, silver, other precious metals too. And conservationists at the National Museum of Scotland have been working on these items over the past few years, making them ready to go on show to the public in Edinburgh from next May, and then touring around Scotland from the end of next year.
Now, they were found by a man called Derek McLennan, but now the Church of Scotland wants its cut. What's it doing and why?
So the Church of Scotland has lodged papers in court beginning formal legal action against Derek McLennan, the man who found the Viking Age hoard with his metal detector. He had received permission from the church to search land it owned in the southwest of Scotland back in 2014, and the discovery he made then was considered, as I've said, of huge national significance. The hoard was valued at almost £2 million, and now the Church of Scotland is claiming a share of the value of the treasure because it was found on its land.
And what does Derek McLennan say?
We've had no response from Derek McLennan. The case is obviously now legally active, but we do know that the church is going through formal procedures because the laws around treasure trove in Scotland are such that initially when an object of historical or cultural significance is found, it is protected and preserved for the benefit of the nation. So the rules of treasure trove are based on Scots common law, and that's different from the law in the rest of the United Kingdom. Here, basically any ownerless object found by chance through activities like metal detecting in this case become the property of the Crown. And then archaeologists establish the value of the items. In this case, the National Museums of Scotland raised the money to buy the treasure from the finder. Now, there seems to be an unwritten rule here in Scotland to ensure that the finders give landowners a share of the value of their finds, but that doesn't seem to have happened in this case.
Just how big a Viking presence was there in Scotland?
Well, there was a significant presence in Scotland, especially in the Northern Isles and around the coast. And experts say this hoard dates back to the 10th century and the foundation of medieval Scotland. Galloway, that's in the southwest of the country, could have been in many ways considered geographically, in some ways politically, central to Ireland, Scotland and England at that time. But there is still a lot of mystery about the hoard. Researchers and conservationists are trying to trace the stories of the objects back to when and where they were made, as well as why they were buried at that time and in that place.
That was Maura Kinnebrough. A new biopic about the American actress and singer Judy Garland is released in the UK next month. Judy charts her last days in London, where she died at the age of 47 from what's thought to have been an unintentional overdose. For her millions of fans, Judy Garland is one of the most enduring Hollywood legends, loved for such cinematic classics as The Wizard of Oz, Meet Me in St. Louis, and A Star is Born. Nicola Stanbridge spoke to her daughter, Lorna Luft, about her mother's influence and why she has such an enduring appeal to her fans.
She was born in a trunk in the new Grand Theatre as baby Frances Ethel Gum.
Lorna Luft is back performing in London. She's the daughter of Sidney Luft, who produced A Star is Born, and it's 50 years after her mother Judy Garland's very last shows here, and where her mother died aged 47.
The first time I played London was the London Palladium. It has a family history.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Sing, sing, sing went my heartstrings. From the moment I saw him, I fell.
My mother played there. My sister played there. I was practically raised over there. My mom moved us all over there when I was 8 years old. And whether it is the Hollywood Bowl, the Crazy Cocks in London, people just want, especially right now, They just want to go and be entertained. As my mother would say, forget your troubles.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away.
My mother made him film I Could Go On Singing, and my brother and I were extras on a scene on a boat going down the Thames.
I could go on singing till the cars come home.
My mom was on the road most of the time we went with her, especially when she was, you know, making a film. And we sort of led in a fun way of gypsy experience.
And you've said that, and I'll quote, I was thinking, am I only ever going to get compared to my mum? So I ran away, I dyed my hair purple, and I sang with Blondie. Can you describe all of that?
There are children of stars, and then there are children of legend. It's a huge shadow. And I dyed my hair purple, sang rock and roll, and became really good friends with Debbie Harry and all of that.
Follow the yellow brick, follow the yellow brick, follow the yellow brick road. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
I've been doing this show, Songs My Mother Taught Me, for quite a while now. And I wanted to make sure that people understood how hard she worked. When she was 37 years old, she had made 39 movies. And she did over 500 radio shows and something like 1,257 concerts. You know, she passed away at the age of 47, and it's just a remarkable legacy.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high.
She touched so many people's hearts. People grew up watching her and watching themselves grow up. She was a human being who, yes, she gave 1,000% of herself through her movies and her television work and her recordings. And that's what I want people to focus on.
That was Lorna Luft, the daughter of the American actress and singer Judy Garland, talking to Nicola Stanbridge. And from the sublime to something else entirely. Corgis are a breed of dog that have been favourites of Queen Elizabeth since the 1930s. And now, with the huge popularity of shows such as The Crown on Netflix, the breed is gaining popularity across the world, no more so than in Asia, where corgi cafes are thriving, as Katie Silver reports.
It's lunchtime in Bangkok, and the cafe Corgi in the Gardens has queues out the door. It opened in January, and its owner, Tan Chinook Kanawong, says business is booming.
We accept 1,000 people a week. Since March, we are really busy.
In come the dogs. There are a dozen of them, with names like Pork Chop, Pumpkin, Salmon, Bean and Baby Corn. For about $12, excited guests play with the pups for 90-minute sessions.
It was a dream to just come here and see so many corgis in one place.
I saw the corgis. They're really cute, short and fuzzy, so I came here to eat and see the corgis.
Corgi, which is Welsh for dwarf dog, are small herding dogs. They've been a long favourite of Queen Elizabeth's, and she's kept some 30 in her life. Now, along with their portrayal in Netflix's The Crown, they feature in the new animated film The Queen's Corgi. It's this fame that have seen corgi cafes pop up in Thailand, Japan and China. Britain's royal pet, it seems, is hot property.
Katie Silver reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or send us pictures of your small yappy dogs or your Viking treasures, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. The dog doesn't have to be yappy. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
The documentary podcast from the BBC World Service takes you to surprising and unexpected places.
This place is so strange.
I'm Asif Kapadia, and that's exactly what's happened to the people in my new series of shows.
Yeah. Any moment that elephant can decide come and destroy your house.
In association with Sundance Institute.
You're not afraid? No.
We'll be meeting people who have taken a detour from the path they thought they were on.
At the beginning, I wanted to be something real and useful.
And ended up somewhere completely different.
The worst moment of my life was fleeing from my country in the middle of the night.
How did I get there?
There's no worse transition than this.
And how did I feel about it?
It doesn't make sense at all.
That's Detours on the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service.
I really believe that I'm making some change.
Just search for the documentary wherever you get your podcasts.